Happy Saturday. It's August 16th, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in sunny California.
And I'm Michael Haney in sunny Europe.
And we are two of your globe-trotting airmail editors who are here to make sense of the news. What a week it's been. One of our favorite television shows collides with one of our least favorite people. The part of the Cotswolds that got a glow-up from Jeremy Clarkson's documentary show Clarkson's Farm has been hosting J.D. Vance this week. The Veep is on vacation in the bucolic countryside hamlet, and he was reported to be having breakfast with Nigel Farage. Oh, what a world. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Trump land, Melania is reminding us once again just how litigious those Trumps can be. Now she's threatening to sue Hunter Biden for $1 billion over his comments linking her to sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. It is kind of astounding to watch this Epstein anxiety continue to mount. As always, Aramel is the antidote to all of it.
Yeah, you know, first, Donald Trump's attack on Harvard has gotten a lot of headlines, but his battle with the University of Virginia has become a major political battleground as well, not just between left and right, but between two possible presidential rivals, J.D. Vance and Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin. And Greg Easley is going to take us inside his reporting on what's happening. Then, speaking of politics, did you know that Gen Z has discovered and recast former President George W. Bush as America's most lovable grandfather? It's a trend that's been dubbed Bush Core, and our writers, Carolina DeArmas and Paulina Prosnitz, will explain what it all means. And finally, it's August, which means the new edition of Airmail Look, our monthly title covering all things beauty and wellness, has launched, and Linda Wells will be here to tell us everything we need to know. Flashy, where would you like to begin today?
Well, Michael, I think we have to start with Bush Corps because there's nothing you and I love more than setting Gen Z straight about things that they don't understand. Just kidding, guys. Sorry. If we had to live through the Bush years, we're going to have opinions on it. That's the way that it is. Let's welcome our wonderful junior editors, Carolina DeArmas and Paulina Prosnitz. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having us, Ashley and Michael.
So before we delve into Bush Corps and your great analysis of it in this week's issue, I would like to know, how old exactly were you when Bush was president?
So I was born in 2000. So I was in diapers for basically the first half of his presidency. And then I was 8 when he left office in 2008.
Yeah, I was 4 years old. But weirdly, Bush was one of my first words.
Okay. So when you guys were coming of age as children, do you have any memories of how Bush was viewed? I mean, we don't have to get too much into the politics of your family homes, but like, what was your impression of him as children and as teenagers?
I basically have one early memory of my mom listening to the radio in the car and just being like, oh, I hate this guy. Like, he is the worst. And that is basically the only clear memory I even have of him being brought up as the president. My first clear memory is actually Obama's inauguration, and his presidency is really what I remember from my childhood.
Same here. I don't remember anything about Bush. I just remember Obama.
You know, history has not looked too kindly on Bush, you know, for the reasons that we all know, the tremendous cost of the ill-advised Iraq war, his tendency towards groupthink, among other unfortunate personality attributes. But he's been recast a bit in the age of Trump, which you all discovered by cruising TikTok and Instagram. So what's the conversation like around Bush on those platforms?
Yeah, we noticed a real uptick in the sort of positive videos of George W. Bush right after Trump's second inauguration earlier this year. He was at the inauguration and he was sort of pictured in the background making funny faces that sort of went viral and got the conversation about him going again. And ever since then, a lot of TikToks recirculating his funniest moments and gaffes from his presidency have gone viral once again. And people are sort of revisiting that period of time with a real nostalgia. The comment section is largely positive, filled with things like, wow, we really had it good with this guy. He was what a real good Republican was. And it's just looking back like with sort of fondness that I think is surprising for a lot of older generations.
Yes, like the chuggy, you know, midlifers among us, like Michael and I, who remember the Bush years very well. You know, so much of Bush's legacy is wrapped up in his handling of the situation in the Middle East. Is that conversation around the Iraq war being revisited online at all? Or are we mostly liking him because he became kind of a dorky painter and made a lot of verbal gaffes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the surprising things in reporting this story, is there are a lot of parallels between Bush's presidency and today, especially when you look at the US's involvement in the Middle East. And what's surprising about that is Gen Z widely is very progressive on those issues, and especially when it comes to the US's involvement militarily. Gen Z for the majority is against that. So it is sort of ironic that they're looking so fondly back at George W. Bush, given, of course, his legacy with the forever wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's sort of one thing that's hard to reconcile. And we talked to some historians and biographers about how that might be the case. And basically, their impression was that because Gen Z was so young during his presidency, they don't have the full historical picture. They're not personally familiar with the nuance of what that period was like, which is sort of how we've reconciled how he's had this renaissance online.
Give me two or three adjectives, each of you, for George W. Bush.
Irreverent. Honestly, I feel like the way that most people describe him online, which I think is just perfect, is very much like a grandfatherly version of The Office's Michael Scott. I think that is the most accurate way to see him as the online persona that TikTok has sort of created, just like this adorable old man who has a lot of gaffes, or Bushisms, as they're actually called. We've known the history. It's just more like, I guess what really surprised us about this trend is that these videos of Bush have always been around. They just so happen to become increasingly popular once Trump, you know, once it was his second inauguration. I think one of the reasons that other generations don't have what Gen Z is currently having with George Bush, Richard Haas told us this and we thought it was really interesting, is that Bush came around specifically around when just filming a president became more common. So we just have more videos of him than other generations have videos of their presidents.
I think people had a lot of mixed feelings at the end of his presidency, to put it lightly, about his skills as a president. But I think what a lot of people felt, and you guys were there, so you can correct me if you're wrong, but I think a lot of people saw him as fundamentally a good person who was trying his best, didn't take himself too seriously, or as one biographer we spoke to put it, like, he was the sort of guy you'd like to have a beer with.
So would you guys want to have a beer with him?
I personally don't. First of all, he's sober.
Maybe a non-alcoholic beer.
Non-alcoholic root beer.
Would you like to have a zero beer with him?
For me, it's more just like, I really just like looking at the videos and laughing at them. But
for our listeners, can you just explain the phrase, watch this drive?
Of course. That's one of our favorites, and it is a fan favorite. He was at the Cape Arundel golf course, which he's actually a member of. Journalists were sort of asking him about, obviously, 9/11 while he's playing the game, mind you. And he just goes, I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers. He suddenly pauses and then goes, now watch this drive, and literally goes on and hits the golf ball. And that is one of the most famous videos, I'd say. And we have a quote from a 25-year-old saying that she quotes Now Watch This Drive almost daily.
So has that just become like a flex of like a little meme of like, check this out now?
Yeah, I think it's really entered the lexicon for Gen Z. And it's just sort of like a funny thing to say at the end of a totally unrelated sentence, you know?
Yeah,
like,
I think it also just really has to do with the Michael Scott aspect of it. Like, The Office was popular because that boss used to be sometimes just like out of touch and not really good on social situations. And that's what Bush gives in a lot of these videos. Like at a press conference when he was waiting for John McCain to show up, he started tap dancing for the reporters. He's just, I don't know, it seems sometimes like he's being disrespectful, but the way that he's goofy about it just then comes off as just this granddad who, like, you forgive for being, you know, not woke.
Well, Carolina and Paulina, thank you so much. If there's one thing that this story reminds us of, it's that the trend of politics as entertainment is not going anywhere.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, so let's move on to more serious matters. Trying to make sense of Trump's approach to universities is a bit of a fool's errand. It's basically punitive. It's basically blackmail. And what's happening at UVA actually is a bit more complicated. Greg Easley is a technologist and an adjunct professor of media studies at the New School. He is a graduate of the University of Virginia, and he began his career in the 1990s as a writer and reporter at Spy Magazine. Welcome, Greg.
Hi, thank you.
So, Greg, as we know all too well, the Trump administration is going after universities in so many ways. And one would have thought that UVA would sort of be outside of this conversation, given that it's in the South, it was founded by Thomas Jefferson, and it tends to skew on the more conservative side. And yet, here we are. So what's going on?
Well, I think that the Trump administration wanted to find a target that was a state school. most of the other targets that are high profile now are the Ivies, obviously private. And my belief is that they were trying to develop a template here that they could use to attack other schools. And they've already started attacking those schools. George Mason in Virginia, that's playing out in real time right now. And then the UC system, you probably read about what's going on at UCLA being attacked now too.
How did this all come to fruition? And take us inside the catalyst. I mean, what got this action and conversation started at UVA? It seemed like things were going along so swimmingly for such a long time.
What started out at the state government level, the governor of Virginia is named Glenn Youngkin. He was elected in part because he made the case that there was too much critical race theory taught in K through 12 schools in Virginia. That was not true. There was no critical race theory being taught in the Virginia secondary schools, but he won the election in part because of that. In the course of his time in office, he basically was shut out by the state legislature. So that became completely Democratic, and he was unable to push many big policy initiatives through because he had no real control. He's basically a lame duck governor. So what he was able to do is focus on higher education. And he had an attorney general who was also a Republican. And the attorney general fired the legal representation of UVA very early in his term. So UVA was effectively left without a lawyer. And at the same time, Governor Youngkin was able to progressively appoint a board of visitors that was aligned with him, all political donors, all heavily conservative.
In what ways was the school not sufficiently conservative?
Well, there's a case being made by a very loud minority of older alumni. You can look into this group. It's called the Jefferson Council, and they love the school. I will say that. They're passionate about the school. But what I think they want is to restore a school that can no longer exist today. To give you some numbers, when I graduated from UVA, it was 78% white, and now it's 51% white. The state has changed. In 1970, there were no women in the school, and now the school is 56% female. It will not go back to this era of the pre-70s where everyone wore coat and tie, everyone was white, and everyone was generally conservative. That day has come and gone, but that seems to be the vision of what is sought in some ways by this group. They would like to see, for example, viewpoint diversity on the faculty. But at the same time, the school has become more dominated by the STEM disciplines and business studies. So there isn't this giant humanities program at UVA that's indoctrinating kids. Most of the kids are studying engineering, math, science, and business. I think it misses the mark of what the school really is. It's a bunch of kids preparing for their futures in the business world. And they're not, I mean, there maybe are some kids that are taking classes that are deemed to be woke, but that's not the majority of the school.
Well, so let's talk about what you're talking about. It's missing the mark. And yet, you know, as you're reporting and insight sort of detailing your story this week, with the Trump administration, there's the mark and then there's the real target. And it seems as though this was also perpetuated in fact by there's a presidential election coming up in 3 years, governor of Virginia, Youngkin, obviously probably going to be candidate, and a guy also serving in the Trump administration, J.D. Vance, right? So what's your theory on how University of Virginia fell into the crosshairs thanks to J.D. Vance?
That's a great question. We started out, the stage was set by Youngkin, but then when Trump won his second election, he was then empowered to make very, very aggressive moves beyond what I think the governor could do by himself. And as you know from the article, he quickly unleashed the Department of Justice on the school. And they made a series of demands that were extraordinary, very, very short timelines to produce, you know, thousands and thousands of pages of admissions records, et cetera. It's basically an impossible task to fulfill. I've had multiple sources tell me that part of what happened here is that Stephen Miller, he has a law firm called America First Legal. He set it up after Trump left office the first time. And it's basically a conservative law firm that pushes anti-DEI efforts, among other things. This group sent a 98-page memo to the Department of Justice in May. And that memo outlined very specific allegations that indicated that Virginia was not, in fact, fulfilling its promises to dismantle DEI. It was a gross oversimplification, as I found in my reporting. But that seems to be originated from AFL because they wanted to damage Glenn Youngkin. Why? Glenn Youngkin is likely to run against J.D. Vance for the nomination for president, if and when Trump leaves. And this was many sources told me that the theory is that this is an attempt to make Youngkin look bad and have him create a mess, which he did, that will prevent him from using this achievement as something that he can run with as a candidate.
One of the sacrificial lambs or the collateral damage here was the head of the university as well, right? Which was a very beloved individual and just sort of like an example of just tearing someone down simply to for the win, right?
Yes, he was a very popular president. He raised $6 billion for the school. He launched multiple new schools. There's a new data science school that was launched under his watch, many others. The school was thriving by almost every account. And it had a few issues along the way, but every school did during this era, the post-George Floyd, the Palestinian protests, et cetera. And most people believe he handled those very well. But he had some vulnerabilities, and those vulnerabilities were exploited by enemies. One of those was a lawyer in Charlottesville who had filed two back-to-back lawsuits against UVA, citing civil rights violations. He basically learned the system of how to sue the school as a private lawyer. And then he was brought on in March to join the Department of Justice. And the irony is this lawyer went to UVA, actually overlapped with me for a year, and he brought his tool book into the DOJ working for Harmeet Dhillon, who was the head of the Civil Rights Department, also went to UVA. She was in the same classes or overlapped with Jim Ryan at UVA Law. So it's very incestuous and very complex, but it was a confluence of different political movements that were able to come together and wreak incredible havoc on the school.
And Greg, how do the students at UVA and the applicant pool feel about all of this?
It's not positive. It's a rudderless ship in some ways right now. The students loved him. My daughter, for example, went on weekly runs with Jim. That's what he called them, run with Jim. And students could just show up and meet him in the morning and go on a run with them. And he got to know the students that way. So he was a wildly popular president with the students. And I think that the school, in no way I can identify benefits from this. I've talked to development officers who are having a very tough time raising money for the school now because it just appears like the school is a mess. Didn't talk to any applicants going into this year, but I did talk to several students that were upset by this. The students at UVA are mildly political, the ones that I know and the ones I've talked to. So they weren't feeling like this was a problem that needed to be solved, that the school was too political, or, you know, they were just going along with their lives happy. And I think most of the students felt that way. And the faculty certainly did feel that way too. They were very supportive of Jim Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really scary that, you know, a school like UVA of all possible institutions is being targeted in this way. I mean, it sort of gives us a sense of how deep the culture wars have permeated within the firmament of the American educational system.
Yeah, I think what's happening is the Trump administration is attacking the institutions that can protest what he does. Okay, so he's obviously attacked the judiciary and stacked the court in the Supreme Court, but he's attacked science. He's attacked the media. He's systematically attacking every institution that can push back. And I think the university is a great example of that. All universities, what they pursue is open discourse, and they pursue enlightenment ideals, which is putting ideas out and figuring out what is right and what is wrong. And I think that is very threatening to the Trump administration.
Greg, is this a template then for, I mean, it seems like for attacking other universities and sort of like this was really like, if they got this right, they can roll this out against other schools?
I believe so. They've already done it at George Mason, which is playing out now. The president there is embattled, but still hanging on. But he also has a board that is controlled by the governor's appointees right now. The bigger one in my mind is attacking the UC system in California. So Virginia is a blue, possibly in a more purple state. It's close to DC. But to attack the UC system, which is in the bastion of the bluest state, California, I think would be a much more ambitious play. But it does seem like they're going for that, and they've already started. So that's in the news playing out today.
Well, Greg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, on a much lighter note, we've got Linda Wells here, the editor of Airmail Look, to tell us all about the beauty and wellness news we need to know. Linda was the founding editor of Allure magazine, a role she held for 25 years, and as Graydon calls her, the Walter Cronkite of all of this great stuff. Welcome, Linda.
I'm so happy to be here, Ashley and Michael.
Okay, Linda, we have to start with the breaking news in the hair world, which is courtesy of our friend Chris McMillan. What is going on?
Oh, stop. Stop the presses. Chris McMillan is the person who is going to make you love your hair. And he is the person who invented the Rachel for Jennifer Aniston, her much copied hairstyle and haircut that she had in Friends. He did the little cap haircut for Michelle Williams, and he did the bob, which has a filthy name, and I'm not sure I'm allowed to say it on airmail or morning meeting, for Leslie Bibb and the White Lotus. So he has a new hair care line, and it's all really about styling, and it's about creating all these great hairstyles for yourself at home. And he says it's foolproof.
Okay, we'll take that. I mean, what are some of Chris's best tips? Like, what? How can he help us without buying these products?
Well, he says first thing you have to do is get a good haircut. Now, of course, he would say that. His haircuts cost $1,200 a piece, but you don't have to get a $1,200 haircut. People have been ignoring haircuts. Ashley, I don't know if you're personally ignoring haircuts, but I think people just sort of moved away from them and just let their hair grow and grow and grow and not even pay attention to it. So he says, you've got to get a clean up, get some shape there, step one. And then he said, don't apply your products to the excess. And I think that we're all guilty of that. But once you apply them, you can't take them away. So put them on sparingly, put them on from the mid-length down. And then I think that we all, I don't know, maybe I try to hurry through my hair and kind of just do it and hope for the best and say a prayer and close my eyes and walk out the door. And that's not a great strategy, oddly enough. He really says that you've got to spend a little time on it. If you spend as much time on your hair as you do on your makeup, contouring and applying all those products, Michael, you know what we're talking about, then you'll actually have a better result. Imagine that.
We also have a really fun story about the changing reputation of carbohydrates.
I know. I mean, protein gets all the love right now and it's getting all the power bars, but carbs have been demonized, but we've discovered there's such a thing as a good carb. And according to numerous studies, they can slow down the aging process and help ward off a long list of chronic diseases. So there's a lot of good news and they're delicious. So the list of carbs that are particularly good, some of them are kind of random, like pears. I don't know about you, but it's been a while since I've just sat down and had a pear. But apparently the skin has a lot of really great phenolic compounds in it, and it's rich in flavonoids, and it's good for the gut microbiome. So go pick a pear. Pasta is not so bad. According to almost 40 studies, medical studies, they've found that pasta doesn't hurt weight loss and it doesn't contribute to weight gain. So maybe we should all be eating it the way the Italians do, which is in smaller quantities. And then there's a list of things like red rice, which sounds kind of bizarre, but it's, you can get it at the grocery store and it's got more fiber and more beneficial ingredients. Raspberries, kidney beans, lentils, kiwi, figs, quinoa, broccoli, green peas.
I'm loving kiwi, by the way. I learned this pro tip that you're supposed to eat it with the skin on because it has so much more fiber. And bizarrely, I like it more than ever.
I mean, it's the one fruit I will not eat. Ugh.
I'm with you. Hate it.
It looks so terrible with that hairy skin.
It's always just something they put on a fruit tray just to fill it out.
It's decorative.
Yeah.
I don't like it at all.
No, it's like garland. Ugh.
Well, I know what I'm serving you guys at my next dinner party. We also have a really great story about Kristen Scott Thomas. Her show Slow Horses is coming back and we're more obsessed with her than ever. And you delve into sort of her approach to beauty and wellness and aging. What did we learn?
Kristen Scott Thomas, of course, she is the most regal, stylish person. Just listening to her say anything makes it feel like poetry or Shakespeare or something. And she has a new movie out that she wrote with her husband, John Micklethwaite of The Economist and Bloomberg. And it's called My Mother's Wedding. And it's based on her own mother and the fact that she had two fathers who died almost exactly the same way. They were best friends and died one right after the other in service. So she writes about that and about this fictional family. But she's also in Slow Horses, and she's so good and frosty and regal and tricky and perfect. But she talks a lot about self-acceptance in aging. I don't know whether you remember Fleabag, but she had one of the most memorable moments in Fleabag when she, with Phoebe Waller-Bridge's, talked about what it's like to age and go through menopause. And it's really surprising because she says it's fantastic. Like, menopause is the greatest thing that ever happened. So she talks also a little bit about being invisible and what that feels like. And there are pluses and minuses to that, and about going gray. And she loves her gray hair, her way of kind of being invisible. And she can travel around London and in the tube and everything, as long as she doesn't wear lipstick and makeup and get herself dolled up. But once she puts the whole kit on, she's recognizable. But she was really fun.
And you know that we're obsessed with sleep, obviously, something that you and I personally are always trying to get more of and higher quality of. What do we have in this issue that takes us deeper into a better, happier night?
Well, you have a great story, Ashley, about you tested out a new pair of earbuds that is really sleep enhancing. So you tell us.
I did not mean to just cue you up for my own story. Well, so here's the problem. It has been so hot in London this summer that we've had to sleep with the windows open. And because we are so far north, it gets light and bright at like 4:30 in the morning, which means that the birds start chirping and chirping and chirping. And I was going absolutely insane. So I tried these sleep buds by Oslo, which is a kind of a random company, but they bought the technology from the Bose sleep buds. So these are basically Bose-ish, you know, noise-canceling sleep buds, but they're formulated to be really comfortable and they just stick in your ear and they don't stick out of your ear. So you don't feel like your ears are getting crunched when you're rolling around at night, like I'm constantly tossing and turning. Anyway, they emit any sort of nature sound you'd like. They can play a podcast. They will automatically turn off when they sense that you're asleep. They track your sleep. I mean, it's very high tech, but they're really, really cool. I think they almost work too well because if you have, for example, small children or babies that wake up in the night, like there's a good chance you're not going to hear them. Like these things are going to put you into such deep REM. I absolutely love them and will no longer live without them, especially on a flight. They're great for that.
They're going on my wish list. I need them very badly.
I'll send you mine, Linda.
Oh, how intimate.
Absolutely. We share it all.
You had a great story, I thought, about microplastics and something that I've been obsessed about. But this was a revelation of a story about, like, there's a test that, you know, might rid you of these or might not. Can you tell me a little bit more about it?
Yeah, it's there's a company in the UK called Clarify, and they take your blood and somehow clear it of microplastics. I don't even know how that's humanly possible, but Orlando Bloom is a believer. So there you have it. It costs $13,000 for one session. And the question is, okay, so if it really does that, how quickly does your body repopulate its microplastics? You know, I mean, I think we're all trying to avoid microplastics, but it is really hard to do. You can throw away all your black spatulas, but what about your gum? And what about your floss? And what about everything else in your life, my Invisaligns, everything's plastic. And so it takes so much work to try to get rid of the plastics in our lives. But I think we're all focusing on this. Now, this hasn't been FDA approved in the US. So I think they've submitted for FDA approval. And if it becomes approved, I wonder how it will fare here and whether scientists will really support this as a reasonable process to take to try to improve your health.
I haven't slept at night since New York Magazine published that story. They suggested we all have a plastic spoon in our brain. Like that visual really stuck with me for some reason.
Oh, God. That's awful.
Yeah, sorry.
These are the things you can't think about because it's like, you know, counting the drops of water in the ocean. It's just, you can't do it. It's built to make you anxious. And so I give up, but I don't drink out of plastic cups anymore.
Plastic free kitchen goals 2025. Let's do it. Linda, another troubling trend, the return of tanning. This keeps popping up. It's like whack-a-mole, like we smack it down and yet it returns.
I know, tanning is back and it's really especially popular among Gen Alpha. And it is the natural tan from the sun or the tan from a tanning bed. Both of them people are really turning back to, which is just absolutely mystifying to me. But I mean, I understand that people love the way it feels. They love the way a tan looks. I mean, even I will compliment people on their tan, and I don't mean it critically. But I mean, there's now a new line of tanning products called Tanning Club. And some of them have SPF 4. I mean, that's what they had in the 80s. And their tagline is bronze responsibly, which I don't even know how you do that. But it's a bit of nostalgia and a belief among some people that we need the sun for vitamin D, we need it for mental health, but it really is not proven. And it's really actually proven to be dangerous. So there are more cases worldwide of skin cancer from indoor tanning than there are of lung cancer from smoking. It's just crazy. This makes me insane. So I wish people would just get their dopamine hit from, I don't know, MDMA and put on SPF 50.
Well, Linda, on that note, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for a great issue.
Enjoy your summer, everyone.
Yes.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene: AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Okay, well, it is the weekend. I know you've got so one thing to share, which is going to be a great recommendation of something cultural we can all enjoy.
Okay, I don't have a recommendation, but I do need to talk about, I feel like you've already seen it. Have you fallen prey to this show, Hunting Wives, on Netflix?
Certainly not, Michael. For once in my life, I have something highbrow to talk about this week. But please, take us into the ether.
No, this is like one of the number one show on Netflix. I just was like, what? I kept getting served up. I looked at it for like, 15 minutes. Anyway, it's many people have probably seen it, and it was supposed to be headed to Stars. I think it was too raunchy even for Stars. It ended up on Netflix, and it basically is very pulpy, and it details this woman who moves down to this town in Texas, and I don't know. I would say don't watch it. If you're going to watch anything this week, and it's August, so everything's kind of slow, I'd say be sure and check out the new season of South Park, which is kind of returned to its form with plenty to look at with Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, Kristen Noem, and others. So if you need anything that's a relief, it kind of makes you feel like someone's taking some shots. And you, my dear, what do you have for us?
All right. Well, I did go to the movie theaters this week, and I saw this incredible documentary called It's Never Over, Jeff Buckley. Have you heard of this?
I watched a trailer for it.
Okay. I saw it in person. It's unbelievable. It's directed by Amy Berg, who has also done documentaries about Janis Joplin and Evan Rachel Wood's allegations of sex abuse against Marilyn Manson. So Jeff Buckley, for our Gen Z listeners, was a musician who came of age in 1990s New York, and he released one album called Grace in 1994 that many critics refer to as one of the greatest 100 albums of all time. I'm certainly of that mindset. And he died suddenly in an accidental drowning in 1997, just as he was getting ready to record his second album, his follow-up album called Songs for My Sweetheart the Drunk with his band. Because he was very famous for a very short period of time in an age before the internet was really much of a thing and social media was certainly a figment of someone's imagination, I didn't know all that much about him. I just have been listening to these albums for the last, 30 years. He's such an incredible musician and vocalist, sort of modeled in a hybrid of Bob Dylan and Prince in terms of his vocal stylings, but really beautiful lyrics. His rendition of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah is the one that I think most people have heard because it's been used in so many films and on television shows. My personal favorite is Last Goodbye. I also love Morning Theft off of his second album. Anyway, he's a great musician and one that we just don't know all that much about. You know, his legend was fairly short-lived. So I think Amy Berg did an incredible job. So it's called It's Never Over, Jeff Buckley, directed by Amy Berg, and it's in theaters now. All right. Well, we wish you all a marvelous weekend. Thank you so much for joining us. Michael, will you please read us out?
Absolutely. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our coders are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. Our debuters are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AIRMEL is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AIRMEL Weekly. We'll be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thank you again for joining us.